You're listening to Talk Geek to Me News number 58, recorded for January the 17th, 2012. You're listening to the Tech Only Hacker Public Radio Edition. To get the full podcast, including political commentary and other controversial topics, please visit www.talkgeektome.us. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. And now the tech roundup. From EFF.org, dated January 12, 2012, by Parker Higgins, the Internet goes to Washington on January the 18th. There's some good news in the efforts to stop the Internet blacklist bill SOPA-PIPA. Representative Daryl Issa, an outspoken SOPA critic and the author of alternative legislation called the Open Act, has announced that the Oversight and Government Reform Committee will hold a hearing on January the 18th to hear from actual technical experts, technology job creators, Internet investors, and legal scholars. EFF's activists will be providing live coverage of the event through our EFF Live Twitter account. A number of online activists are strategizing plans for a SOPA blackout, censoring websites and logos to draw attention to the hearing and showcase the widespread opposition to the censorship bills. We're glad to see lots of sites participating, and we're urging folks to use social networks on January the 18th to help spread the word. The Oversight Committee hearing will address the topic of domain name service and search engine blocks generally, and explore ways for the government to avoid legislation that would hamper economic growth. Of course, as active and controversial legislation, SOPA and its evil twin in the Senate, the Protect IP Act, PIPA, are certain to be discussed at length. Here's a look at the witness scheduled to speak. Alexis Ohanian is a founder of Reddit, the social news platform that has been the site of numerous anti-SOPA discussions. He's spoken out against the bill personally, saying, quote, "This legislation affects my entire industry and livelihood. We never would have been able to start Reddit if SOPA were the law, and I worry about all of the future innovation we'd miss out on if it were to pass," unquote. Stuart Baker, the former Homeland Security Assistant Secretary and former General Counsel for the NSA, is certainly an expert on the issue of cybersecurity and the law. He's also been a vocal critic of SOPA, explaining the security problems with the original bill and the manager's amendment in an extremely cogent blog post titled "SOPA Rope a Dopa." Brad Burnham is a founder of the prestigious Union Square venture investment firm. Union Square has been behind some very high-profile tech companies like Twitter and Foursquare in the 7 years since its founding, supporting job creation and innovation in the tech sector. Burnham is rightly concerned that legislation like SOPA could undermine his investments and the Internet itself. In a personal blog post, he lays out the problem, quote, "The current legislation in Congress does not just create an administrative burden, it requires service providers who have built wonderful businesses on the deep conviction about human nature to change their relationship with their users in a way that subverts their core values." Daniel Kaminsky is a well-known security expert known for discovering a major vulnerability in the DNS system, the sort that DNSSEC initiative is designed to address. He is one of 21 trusted community representatives involved in the DNSSEC implementation process. He is a signer of the open letter from the Internet Engineers, first published by EFF and read into the congressional record by Representative Issa. Michael McLeod Ball is the Chief of Staff and First Amendment Counsel for the ACLU, so he's likely to raise the major constitutional issues present in SOPA. The ACLU has publicly opposed SOPA on First Amendment grounds, so we expect a free speech focus. To read the rest of this article, follow links in the show notes. From EFF.org, dated January 10th, 2012, by Katitza Rodriguez, biometrics in Argentina, mass surveillance as a state policy. 2 years ago, the UK dismantled their national ID scheme and shredded their national identity registry in response to great public outcry over the privacy invasive program. Unfortunately, privacy protections have been less rosy elsewhere. In Argentina, the national ID fight was lost some time ago. A law enacted during the military dictatorship forced all individuals to obtain a government-mandated ID. Now they are in the process of enhancing its mandatory National Registry of Persons with biometric data such as fingerprints and digitized faces. The government plans to repurpose this database in order to facilitate easy access to law enforcement by merging this data into a new security-focused integrated system. This raises the specter of mass surveillance, as Argentinian law enforcement will have access to mass repositories of citizen information and be able to leverage existing facial recognition and fingerprint matching technologies in order to identify any citizen anywhere. In the waning days of 2011, Argentinian President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner issued an executive decree ordering the creation of the federal system of biometric identification, a new centralized nationwide biometric ID service that will allow law enforcement to cross-reference information with biometric and other data initially collected for the purpose of operating a general national ID registry. Historically, police fingerprint databases were limited to those suspected or convicted of criminal offenses. Recently, however, the Argentinian Federal Police was given a large database holding digital fingerprints collected from random Argentinians as part of the national ID and passport application process. Since March 2011, this database has been fed by data collected through the RENAPA National ID application process. The PFA has managed to amass a database of about 8 million fingerprints, yet this process appears to have been too slow for the Argentinian government. Further to the new decree, the CBIOS initiative will give PFA access to RENAPA's database and vice versa, doubling PFA's reach to approximately 14 million digitized fingerprints. Starting with the first New Year's baby of 2012, Argentina has even begun registering newborn biometric information with the CBIOS. Argentina projects that, as national IDs and passports expire and are renewed and new babies are born, that CBIOS database will grow to over 40 million within the next 2 years. To read the rest of this article about Argentina's biometric database, follow links in the show notes. From TorrentFreak.com by Enigmex, dated January 9, 2012, Pirate Bay shows futility of domain and DNS blocks. In October 2011, a court in Finland ordered local ISP Elisa to block the Pirate Bay to stop copyright infringement among its subscribers. Today, the blockade, which covers many domains and IP addresses, took effect. But behind the scenes, there is an effort to unblock the site and render the court order useless. Meanwhile, there is already collateral damage. The court order has succeeded in blocking a domain linking to the Electronic Frontier Finland. In May 2011, the Copyright Information Anti-Piracy Center, CIAPC, and the Finnish branch of the music industry group, IFPI, filed a lawsuit in the District Court of Helsinki. The groups demanded that the local ISP Elisa should be forced to protect the copyrights of their members by stopping their subscribers accessing the Pirate Bay. Initially, Elisa refused, described the block demands as unreasonable, but a subsequent court order left them with no choice. On October 26, 2011, the District Court of Helsinki ordered Elisa to block a range of domains and IP addresses associated with the Pirate Bay. Although Elisa has contested the decision by filing with the Helsinki Court of Appeal, in the meantime they have to comply. Today, Elisa confirmed it has begun blocking the domains and IP addresses listed below. A long list follows. IP addresses to be blocked. Three IP addresses follow. During the war between Finland and Russia, some Swedes decided to help Finland. They said, "The Finnish cause is ours." A Pirate Bay insider told Torrent Freak, signaling their intention to circumvent the block. The Pirate Bay originates from Sweden, so the Pirate Bay will see the Finnish cause as its own, only this time It's against the copyright Russians, he's concluded. And it appears the battle for the cause has already begun. The last domain on that list certainly piqued our interest, and not only because it includes a typo. The NYUD.net domain belongs to the peer-to-peer-based Coral CDN service, which links to IP addresses all over the world, which is generally a good tool to make blocked sites accessible again. Ironically enough, the domain in question reveals a very easy way to bypass the Pirate Bay blockade in Finland. Just use one of the alternative domains associated with the Pirate Bay, add nyud.net, example, dpiratebe, which is a Finnish spelling, .be.nyud.net, and the most resilient torrent site becomes accessible again in Finland. While this block can temporarily stop the basic file sharer from using the Pirate Bay, we already see a surge of interest in blocking technology, censorship, net neutrality, copyright legislation, and court practice in the media, Junus Mäkinen of Finland's Pirate Party told Torrent Freak. This probably ends up being beneficial to file sharing and shows the blocking attempts to be counterproductive. Side effects will be that the more blocks there are, the more workarounds people learn. This could severely hinder solving important crimes in the future, he concludes. To read the rest of this article, follow the links in the show notes. From TechDirt.com, by Glenn Moody, dated January 13, 2012, Why Apple Will Not Be Part of the Real Tablet Revolution. You don't have to be a marketing genius or industry pundit to foresee that tablets will be an extremely hot sector in 2012. The launch of Apple's iPad in 2010 largely defined the category, just as the launch of the iPhone defined a new kind of smartphone in 2007. In 2012, we will probably begin to see Android tablets start to gain major market share, just as Android smartphones have done this year. Currently, the tablet is something of a cross between the hipster tech toy of choice and a trivially easy-to-use computing device for couch potatoes. But those early sectors are incidental to the tablet's real potential to revolutionize education, particularly in emerging economies. The devices are perfect. They are compact, connect to the net wirelessly, run off battery power for hours, and can be used by children and adults alike with little or no training. There's just one problem, of course. The typical tablet's high-end pricing, hundreds of dollars, places it so far out of reach for most of the world's population that it might as well not exist for them. But that is what makes India's Akash tablet, basic cost around $50, but only $37 for Indian students thanks to a government subsidy, so remarkable and so important. Of course, its specifications are somewhat limited compared to the iPad. 256 megabytes of RAM, 2 gigabytes flash memory, a 7-inch 800x480 pixel resistive touchscreen. But that's not really the point. The key issue is whether it is good enough for the educational purposes governments around the world have in mind. For although the Akash began as a project purely for India, it has been swiftly taken up by a number of other countries, as this fascinating feature about the creation of Akash by the Canadian wireless device maker Datawind explains. Quote, Datawind CEO Sunit was invited to meet with Thailand's Minister for Information Communications Technology, who was so interested in purchasing 10 million tablets that he attended their meeting even as floodwaters descended on Bangkok. Calls arrived from Turkey, which wants 15 million tablets, Sri Lanka, Trinidad and Tobago, Panama and Egypt. This gives an indication of the potential of the Akash low-cost tablet to provide portable computing devices and with them access to digital knowledge on a truly global scale. The feature also explains how exactly Datawind managed to produce a tablet for a tenth of the cost of an iPad. Quote, part of the difficulty in engineering such a device is that the underlying goal, that its final price should be within the means of those who can't afford high-priced tablets, dictates crucial engineering and component decisions. A piece of high-impact resistant glass, such as the touchscreen face of an iPod, can cost upward of $20. Datawind's touchscreen glass, which the company had engineered down the street, cost less than $2, though it won't allow for luxuries like pinch and zoom finger swiping. There were also compromises on processing power. DataWin's 366 MHz processor cost less than $5, a fraction of the $15 price tag on the chips that power iPads and other comparable tablets. And while a decision to run Google's free Android mobile operating system on the gadget saves money, it requires coders to dig deep into the Linux kernel that underpins the software, tweaking it until it runs smoothly on DataWin's weaker processor. As that makes clear, one key ingredient in the design of the Akash was Android, and hence free software. This meant that DataWin's software engineers were able to build on several years' work by Google and two decades of coding by the Linux community, rather than starting from scratch. It's a reminder that even if, as seems likely, Apple's iPad retains its highly profitable hold on the upper end of the market, it will never be able to offer a model that is competitive with minimalist tablets built around free software at the bottom. And since it is precisely those ultra-cheap models that will be sold in their hundreds of millions, perhaps even billions one day, that means that the real tablet revolution, the one that will transform education in emerging economies and with it their societies, will not be one in which Apple plays a major part, despite its early leadership there. From TorrentFreak.com, by Ernesto, dated January 13, 2012. The Pirate Bay will stop serving torrents. In a month, the Pirate Bay will no longer offer downloads of .torrent files. Instead, the largest torrent site on the internet will only provide so-called magnet links to its visitors. The first step in this direction was made today, with the Pirate Bay replacing the current default torrent download links with magnets. Could this be the end of an era? After half a decade of loyal service, the Pirate Bay shut down its tracker in November 2009. The Pirate Bay argued that BitTorrent trackers have been made redundant by technologies such as DHT and PEX. In addition, the Pirate Bay team said that they might move away from torrents entirely and switch to offering magnet links instead. We're talking to the other torrent admins on doing magnet links and DHT and PEX for all sites, moving away from torrents and trackers totally, like pick a date and all agree from this date we'll not support torrents anymore, a Pirate Bay insider told Torrent Freak at the time. Now, 2 years later, that date is coming soon. Today, the Pirate Bay made the first step towards this new future by making magnets the default download links instead of torrents. Torrent Freak was further informed that in a month or so, that the largest torrent site on the internet will stop serving torrent files indefinitely. The announcement is bound to lead to confusion and uncertainty among many torrent users, but in reality, very little will change for the average Pirate Bay visitor. Users will still be able to download files, but these will now be started through a magnet link instead of a .torrent file. Pirate Bay team told Torrent Freak that one of the advantages of the transition to a magnet site is that it requires relatively little bandwidth to host a proxy. This is topical since this week courts in both Finland and the Netherlands ordered local internet providers to block the torrent site. Perhaps even better, without the torrent files, everyone can soon host a full copy of the Pirate Bay on a USB thumb drive, which may come in handy in the future. Unlike the site's users, existing torrent sites that scrape .torrent files from the Pirate Bay will have to make some drastic changes. If they want to continue serving .torrent files, they will have to fetch them from DHT. Also, hot links to .torrent files will stop working and will soon redirect to the Pirate Bay's detail page for the files in question. One of the potential downsides of using magnets is that it could take a bit longer for downloads to start, especially if there are relatively few people sharing a file. This is because the .torrent file has to be fetched from other users instead of being downloaded directly from the site. More background on these and other technicalities can be found here. The good news is that all mainstream BitTorrent clients support magnet links. This wasn't the case back in 2009, but when the Pirate Bay hinted that in the future they could become a magnet-only site, all developers quickly made their clients fully compatible. There's no doubt that a torrentless Pirate Bay will certainly mark the end of an era. At the moment, it's hard to predict what the impact of the Pirate Bay's decision will be on the BitTorrent community. But torrents, however, will never disappear completely. News from IcelandReview.com, DissentingDemocrat.wordpress.com, MaggieMcNeil.wordpress.com, SpankTheSpooky.blogspot.com, and TechDirt.com used under arranged permission. News from EFF.org and TorrentFreak.com used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution License. News from DemocracyNow.org used under permission of the Creative Commons by Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Audio Interlude, Moment of Clarity number 106, used under permission of Lee Camp. News sources retain their respective copyrights. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me. Here are the vital statistics for this program. Your feedback matters to me. Please send your comments to dg@deepgeek.us. The webpage for this program is at www.talkgeektome.us. You can subscribe to me on Identica as the username DeepGeek, or you could follow me on Twitter. My username there is DGTGTM, as in Deep Geek, Talk Geek to Me. This episode of Talk Geek to Me is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 Unported License. This license allows commercial reuse of the work, as well as allowing you to modify the work, so long as you share alike the same rights you have received under this license. Thank you for listening to this episode of Talk Geek to Me.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HPR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.